Morning.
I'm Stephen Merman. I'm here today on behalf of Andarian McInnes, the appellant defendant. After 2 days...
Three minutes, yes, sir.
After 2 full days of emotional testimony, the appellant was convicted of robbery, conspiracy, 2 firearm offenses, and he was acquitted of the first-degree murder. And the facts have been laid out very well in both briefs, so I won't go down there unless your honors would like me to. Now, the sentencing phase is the part of the trial that we're dealing with today.
Do you agree that the Facebook evidence that the Commonwealth offered at sentencing would or may have been appropriate as rebuttal evidence at sentencing?
I do.
But not to offer at the outset?
Absolutely.
But it was not objected to either, was it?
It was objected to.
That it went beyond the statute?
It was objected to
on relevance, wasn't it?
At the bench and by subsequent order entered by the court for relevance, prejudicial nature, and uncertainty regarding where the drugs that were advertised on Facebook came from.
All evidence that the Commonwealth admits at sentencing is prejudicial to the defendant. I think we can start with that assumption. And then we move on to relevancy. Well, this would have been relevant to present perhaps to a trial judge at sentencing, would it not?
It would have been relevant, Your Honor, in the guilt phase. It would have potentially been relevant had my client testified and said something which opened the door to
but
it
I'm
being...
I'm talking about it. Say it had been a bench trial, and a judge is at sentencing. Wouldn't it have been relevant at that point to show that he was involved in drugs beyond just this particular instance?
In a judge trial, perhaps, but 295.1 wouldn't have kicked
in. So it's the only thing that makes it inadmissible in this trial is the fact that it was a jury sentencing and the information that the statute allows the jury to hear is quite limited.
Absolutely. Yes, sir.
Was that statute ever mentioned to the trial judge?
It was not. Specifically, it was not. It was mentioned in the order that the evidence was irrelevant, quote, during sentencing. We were in not the guilt phase of this trial at that point. We were in the sentencing phase at that point.
But don't you think if you had mentioned the statute to the judge's ruling might have been different?
I wish I knew the answer. It could have been. I'll submit to the court that this matter was taken up at the bench, after 2 full days of rigorous trial, lots of emotion going on, and the Commonwealth decided that morning that they were going to present 3 motions out of the hearing of the folks in the pews, because we're talking about a packed courtroom with cameras and lots of media and lots of emotion because he had been acquitted of the murder. And the judge allowed the Commonwealth and myself to approach the bench, and it was dealt with at the bench. Of course, in hindsight, I would have had liked a little more time to prepare, but I had no notice or knowledge of what the Commonwealth was going to spring at that moment. What I did know and what I did preserve was the fact that it was not relevant during sentencing. We were in a specific phase of this trial, not the guilt phase, but the sentencing phase.
But we've held so many times that just a general objection is not sufficient. It has to be specific. And this statute is very specific as to what may be presented to the jury. And that's the, I think, 6 items of evidence that constitutes victim impact testimony. So it would seem to me to be specific, you would have to reference that statute and tell the judge why this evidence is not admissible in a jury sentencing context.
Yes, Your Honor. The only response I have is that because it was the sentencing phase of the trial, it was clear that my objection dealt with its relevancy during the sentencing phase of a trial. Again, this was a matter that was taken up at the bench after the guilt phase via surprise, and it was dealt with at the bench. Sometime later, of course, it was put on the record, my specific objection, and I didn't try to change the wording of my objection in the court order that was entered because I felt that was not appropriate. I said what I said at the bench, and I said what I said at the bench in the paper order itself, and that's what was entered. The specificity of the objection, if we look at 5A18, requires that it be stated with reasonable certainty. So the issue that I've tackled up until this day and that your honors will look at carefully is whether or not there was reasonable certainty in the wording of my objection, specifically that it was not relevant at sentencing. Had that objection been made not relevant during the course of the trial, I would agree that it would have not been specific enough. I would have had to have supplemented that not relevant objection with something more. But because of the timing of that objection, there could have been no other understanding of relevancy because it was during the sentencing phase.
But, you know, when we look at evidence, before evidence can be introduced, it has to be two things. It has to be relevant, as you've mentioned, and it has to be admissible. It seems to me that this evidence is relevant in that it has something to do with the offense for which he's on trial, but it's not admissible. You raised the relevancy, but it's the admissibility objection that seems to me to control here.
The prejudicial nature of it would have made it inadmissible as well. I'd submit to the court that because it was the sentencing phase, we would have had absolutely no opportunity to rebut that testimony. The only link between the Facebook name that was purportedly used by Mr. McGinnis came from a witness during the trial, a Commonwealth's witness. She was cross-examined at that point on the information that she testified to, which did not include the Facebook post that was brought out during the sentencing phase. Defendant would have had absolutely no idea that that would have been brought out in the sentencing phase because it's specifically not allowed under 19.2.295.1. Had we known or had noticed, then perhaps it would have been, we could have prepared more for that. The court's point is that the two requirements, admissibility being one of them, could the objection have been more specific? Well, I think it's obvious it could have. Was it specific enough? I submit to the court that because of the nature of the proceeding at that moment when the objection was made, it was undeniably an objection based on its inadmissibility pursuant to the requirements of 295.1, even though it was not specifically cited. The Commonwealth has mentioned in the relevancy issue about sanitizing the evidence. Two cases were cited, Hope v. Commonwealth and Scott v. Commonwealth. Both of those dealt with the admissibility of evidence during the trial phase, not during the sentencing phase. And that's what I'm trying to impress upon your honors today, is that the issue that we dealt with at that 3 minutes in time had to do only with what was to take place during the sentencing portion of this trial. The probative versus prejudicial part of my argument, the detective was put on the stand to testify about those posts by, his name was Left Field James, but he wasn't able to respond at the sentencing phase because, again, we had no notice that that was coming. The Commonwealth chose to bring it out not during the trial, but only during the sentencing phase. The jury was already emotionally charged, and the posts specifically alleged that Mr. McGinnis had Xanax for sale after this victim was killed and robbed of Xanax. And I submit, I can't think of anything that would be more prejudicial just before sentencing and clearly not permitted by the statute than the evidence which came in. Under 295.1, the Commonwealth has mentioned that the rebuttal aspect of it. Would it have been able to come in and rebuttal. Well, the detective testified about these Facebook posts right out of the bat on the third day of trial during the sentencing phase. Nobody testified before him, so it clearly wasn't rebuttal. And creatively, again, the Commonwealth suggests that perhaps it was merely out of order. However, there was nothing to rebut at that point, so I think that argument fails.
Ms. Mayor, you filed a motion to set aside the verdict in this case, did you not?
I did.
Did you make the argument at that point that the evidence was inadmissible for purposes of sentencing?
I maintained the argument that I made at the bench. I didn't sway from what was said at the bench on the off the record at that moment.
And that was, of course, some time after the conviction?
It was, Your Honor. I stand here today, the relief requested by the appellant. Again, this was a trial. He was acquitted of murder, and as the court is aware, there was some substantial time taken away from the jury verdict. But the appellant has asked me to ask that the conviction or sentence that was imposed be set aside and the matter remanded for further proceedings. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Stollard.
Good morning again, Your Honors. Craig Stollard on behalf of the Commonwealth.
Context sometimes does make a difference, doesn't it? And in this particular instance, the context of what we're talking about was sentencing, where the Commonwealth is restricted to victim impact evidence and the criminal record until or unless the defense opens the door, in which case then maybe some rebuttal. But in the context of sentencing, wasn't the Facebook evidence irrelevant to what's permitted under Section 19.2, 295.1?
I understand the court's concerns. I don't think it's as clear-cut as that. I think there's a couple things going on here. First of all, I think there's a difference between something being irrelevant for a lot of reasons and being irrelevant because it's not covered by the statute.
That's the admissibility. Irrelevant is one requirement for admission. Admissibility is the other. Things can be incredibly relevant, but otherwise inadmissible.
That's correct, Your Honor. And I think if the statement had been, Your Honor, this is irrelevant under the code section, this is irrelevant because the code limits the evidence that can be presented.
But do you agree that this is not victim impact testimony?
It is not victim impact and is not criminal record. I agree with that. However, I will say that the same statute does say this is the fact that there's an order in which the evidence is to be presented. And in that nature, it's a procedural statute. The Commonwealth's case in chief is criminal record and victim impact. The defendant then would have an opportunity to rebut that or put on any evidence of mitigation it deems appropriate. At that point, the Commonwealth can then present whatever evidence it deems relevant and admissible at that time.
But if the Commonwealth goes out of order, then they've taken away the opportunity for the defense to say, I'm not hurt that badly, I'm not going to say a thing, yeah. So you get no rebuttal.
Well, there's a couple things there. I mean, first of all, I think Mr. Merman just said that he didn't have an opportunity to rebut this because the way that the Commonwealth presented it. However, I think in this case, just the opposite happened. I mean, this evidence came on, and then the defendant had an opportunity to testify and say, well, wait a second. That's not what happened. That's not true.
But let me ask you, the term rebuttal does not mean a second chance to introduce evidence that you forgot to introduce the first time.
I agree with
rebuttal
that.
Means rebuttal to evidence presented by the defendant.
True.
What evidence presented by the defendant did this Facebook rebut?
Well, let me just say, I believe counsel just, this court asked the question, would this have been admissible in rebuttal, and he agreed that it would be, but even regardless of that, I think the defendant got on the stand and basically said, where I live, I got desensitized to violence, I'm going to change my life, things are going to go moving forward, I understand the problems I have, so forth and so on. And this evidence shows that immediately after essentially ordering somebody to be murdered by saying, pop him, during a drug deal gone bad, and stealing a large quantity of drugs from the person who was dying in the car, he then goes home and then sells those drugs. His mindset at the time is counter to what he's saying at the time about, I understand I was wrong, the things I'm going to change. Because at the time, right after someone was murdered, he's thinking about making a profit off of that.
But at the time that the rebuttal evidence was offered, there was nothing that had been said by the defense yet in the sentencing phase. Isn't that true?
That is true. And I'd also say, you know, as far as probative and prejudicial, at the time this testimony was put forward, I think the jury already knew this information. This was nothing the jury didn't either already know or could gather from the evidence presented. I mean, during the guilt phase, again, the evidence was pretty clear. Mr. McGinnis and his co-defendant went to this car, presumably to make a drug deal. The dealers end up murdered. They steal the drugs. So we have a situation where he comes into possession of over 300 tabs of Xanax. It's not a huge leap of faith that the reason he took that is to sell it. I mean, the jury probably...
That's a harmless error argument, isn't it?
It's also an argument that there's no prejudice. I mean, because this is things the jury already
but
knew.
But we don't know whether there's prejudice or not, because we don't know why the jury decided to impose the sentence it did.
We don't. And I think, again, I mean, my reading of the defendant's testimony, he was fairly strident and abrupt with Commonwealth on cross. And that may have had a factor to do with sentencing as well. I mean... It's difficult to get into the mind of a jury and figure out why they did what they did. I mean, for instance, in this case, they convicted him of use of a firearm in the murder, but acquitted him of the murder, which is an inconsistent verdict, but the juries are allowed to do that. So it's like we don't know what they were thinking to come up with that verdict. But clearly they felt somehow he was responsible for the murder. So the fact that they acquit him of the murder and he's got a large quantity of time, it's like, well, he's still responsible for this death. We can't give it to him on the murder. We can give it on the other charges. And I think that's the kind of thing that courts are reluctant to do is go behind juries, find out why they did what they did, try to second-guess those decisions. Here, I think the evidence the Commonwealth presented during sentencing was ultimately relevant and would have been admissible had it been done in the proper order. And if the problem is the ordering, I think it's a procedural statute. That's not fatal. That doesn't cause reversal. Now, if the court finds that it never would have been admissible for rebuttal, then we have a different situation here. And then the question becomes, I guess, do we remand for resentencing, I presume, on all the
remaining charges? I mean, it seems to me that if the judge had been presented with the statute, saying, Judge, this is victim impact testimony. Statute says only victim impact testimony is admissible. This evidence doesn't qualify. It seems to me that the trial judge quite probably would have said, you're right. That's the problem I'm having.
Okay, well, I think what likely would have happened, he says, you're right, you can't put that on until or unless... the defendant puts on evidence also. And we don't know if the Commonwealth had not presented that, if the defendant wouldn't have testified. Now, again, trial strategy changes at the moment, and I did defense work for 8 years. I don't want to go do it again because it's a very stressful, difficult thing. And I definitely sympathize with Mr. Murmur. I've had the 518 throughout a man appeal before, too, and it's not fun. Because you're in the middle of a trial, you got 8,000 things you're trying to do simultaneously. You don't say the magic words, and months, years later, that bites you. And I understand that. But I also think if the right objection had been made, if he'd said, Your Honor, the statute says you can't do that, the judge likely, I think, would have said, you can't do it immediately, but it will address it again after or depending on what evidence the defense puts on in mitigation. Because it's not an all-or-nothing situation, because the code section specifically says this is not meant to limit the Commonwealth's evidence for rebuttal.
But if we accept that argument, we have to presume that the defendant would have testified at that point. We don't know. I mean, the defendant might have, as Judge Huff mentioned, might have said, hey, I'm okay with not testifying.
I agree that that's a possibility, but I will say that it doesn't appear from his testimony specifically that he spent a great deal of time in his testimony specifically trying to rebut that specific evidence. His clear thing was saying there was an act of violence. I want to explain why there was this violence and how my life is going to be different. He didn't really address the Facebook post dealing with the drug dealing. So it seems to me that that's the type of evidence you're going to put on regardless, because you want to try to humanize the defendant for the jury because they're about to make a very important decision in his life. And it's like, I think the jury, as a defense attorney, you realize the jury's going to want to hear from him and see that he acknowledges what he's done wrong, how he's going to make his life better, and why you shouldn't give him several life sentences. And the fact that during his testimony, it's not like the only thing he talked about in his testimony was, look, this drug dealing thing, that's not a thing I did. That wasn't my Facebook post. I didn't do that. I didn't sell the drugs. He's talking about, I grew up in an area where violence was common. I got desensitized to the violence. I didn't realize I was desensitized until we came here today and I heard these witnesses testify about how difficult this was for everybody involved. He's talking about how he's trying to change his life, not about drug dealing or not drug dealing, Facebook or not Facebook. So, I think it's a reasonable inference you can make that that's the type of testimony that would be presented regardless of the order the Commonwealth put on their evidence. I do think this is an interesting question. I mean, the statute is clear. This is what you do first, and this is what you do in rebuttal. Commonwealth went out of turn, and I acknowledge that because that's what happened. The question is, was it so badly out of turn that it's reversible, or is it just a situation that things went out of order in its procedural statute, and we had so substantial.
That argument kind of reminds me of the scenario used to pop up periodically where the trial court improperly allows a statement made by the defendant into evidence, and then the defendant has to get up and explain that statement, and the Commonwealth then said, well, it might have been improper, but because the defendant testified, it would have come in rebuttal anyway, so it's okay. And the courts have held, no, that's not the case.
Well, I agree. And if Mr. McGinnis had testified, and the sole subject of his testimony was about the Facebook post, and that was it, then I think there would be a very logical and cohesive argument. And my position on brief might be a little bit different. But that's not what his testimony was. He didn't just touch on that one thing. He touched on a lot of things that dealt with sentencing and all the charges he was convicted of.
But if we accept your argument, it's almost as if the Commonwealth then has free rein to put anything on it wants in the initial portion of sentencing, knowing full well that the defendant's going to have to get up and say something anyway.
Well, I think if you have a situation where bad faith is clearly established, then I think we were going to have a different situation. I think what was going on is nobody was actually reading the statute.
Ah.
it was just, for lack of a better word, ignorance. It's like, we can put on evidence, because my understanding, what I was doing trial work, and maybe I didn't read the statute as often as I could, is like, Commonwealth gets put on everything they want to in aggravating, defense puts on anything they want to in mitigation. That's the way you do sentencing. But if there's a jury sitting there, the rules are different. I wasn't fully aware of the differences until I went back and read the statute again, but they have been limited. But again, it's only limited in what they can do in the case in chief. On rebuttal, I think we're back to the general terms, like anything aggravating they can put on, and of course the defense is allowed to put on anything they want in mitigating, and let the jury come up with a fair sentence. And I think merely because we've gone out of order, I don't think we have reversible error. And also, again, to the extent the argument this is overly prejudicial, I think because of the nature of the evidence, the guilt phase, nothing that could have been presented in sentencing would have been overly prejudicial given the facts of this case. And again, I understand the court's concerns, and this isn't an easy one, but I think clearly, given the totality of circumstances, I would ask the court to affirm.
Let me ask you this, and I'll ask Mr. Merriman this also. If we accept his argument, this case would go back for simply a new sentencing hearing, would it not?
Well, it would. And given the fact that this was a jury sentencing, then we have the situation of impaneling a new jury.
But that's what the statute says, isn't it?
It is, yeah. Okay. And then we have the issue again about what evidence would be available to be presented to that jury in order to get the sentence. And there are a number of cases talking about that as well. You can either read the testimony. There's a question of whether or not you can actually do a summary of the evidence. So if that's the route the court's going to go, I mean, the court's not really an issue before the court, but there's going to be that issue like what you can and can't do at sentencing with a jury that never heard the guilt evidence. So that comes into play a little bit as well, I think, for the court to take that into consideration if it ends up going that way. But I'd suggest the issue isn't properly preserved, and second, any error was essentially harmless in that there was no prejudicial impact to the defendants. I would suggest the court does not need to have a resentencing. But I submit to the court unless the court has any additional questions.
Hearing none. We thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Merriman.
Thank you, judges.
Mr. Merriman, can I touch that point with you real quickly? Is that the proper remedy here? To remand, if we agree with your argument, to remand this for new sentencing in front of a different jury. That's the statutory requirement.
Counsel touched on something that's important, and I know that Your Honors have heard it before. There's so much going on in such a confined space and period of time that when that evidence came in, the decision to allow Mr. McInnes to testify and what the substance of that testimony would be, the easy part for me was to say, stay away from the Facebook stuff, because now we're opening up a door that perhaps then would have allowed an experienced prosecutor to take a shot at him in almost a guilt phase-like manner. And I just didn't think that he could have withstood that kind of cross-examination. Sometimes our clients listen to our advice, and sometimes they just don't. I would like to say one final thing regarding the issue of 295.1 and whether it was contemplated in the discussion. Inviting the court's attention to Joint Appendix 596, I'd refresh the memory of counsel and all of us that there were three issues that we approached for. Number one was a media issue that I didn't take exception to. I didn't care. I didn't have an opinion of it. And that was granted. They were just not going to take face shots of people testifying. That's fine. Number two was the Facebook issue. And, of course, we know what I did there. I did take issue with it. And the third one was an issue of pending charges. Mr. McInnes had apparently gotten into some trouble inside the jail. It was a charge that came up. And the Commonwealth at that point wanted to bring that in as well. And the discussion on Joint Appendix 596, top of the page, dealt with the court referencing the admissibility of it and referencing specifically that perhaps in a capital case that type of testimony would be admissible, but she did not allow that in. And it suggested to the court that it was in the minds without specificity of those gathered at the bench that morning. And I'll end on that note, and thank you for listening.
Thank you. We will step down and greet counsel, and that concludes the docket for the